Hey, everybody. Chris Chico just coming on the call, and I'm going to go ahead and go on mute, get some water so we can go ahead and get the call started. So waiting on everybody else to show up. I'll be back in a few minutes.
Hello. No one's on yet.
Calvin.
Hey, Chris.
Calvin. Hey, buddy. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks. I'm here. I'm on the call.
Okay. So yeah, I was just muted here for a second. So I'll be back in a few minutes.
All right. No problem.
Okay. All right, I'm back. So just waiting to see. Actually, we're just going to, it's 3:03. I'm going to give it two more minutes, and then we will start the call.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and get started on the call. I got some people still coming in. So let me just get my notes here. So everybody, welcome to today's huddle call. This call is every Tuesday at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. The call will be about an hour, could be less, depending on the number of questions asked. Let me turn off my Skype here.
Sorry, Chris, that was me.
Okay, no problem. So, we're going to go ahead. I have a couple topics to discuss at the beginning of the call, and then we're going to go ahead and we're going to open up the line for questions. As always, you can raise your hand by pressing *5 to raise your hand and *5 again in order to lower your hand. And as always, say your question first and then give us a backstory to try and make this call as efficient as possible. Remember, if you need anything from us, you can email support@salesteamlive.com. support@salesteamlive.com. Anything related to your marketing campaigns, your VAs, or almost anything technical, including Podio. However, if you need help with any of your deals or things that you've got going on with buyers and sellers, then use dealhelp@reivault.com. That's dealhelp@reivault.com. A couple quick updates. Last week, we had sent out an email with a link for you guys to provide metrics. We've had a few people that have submitted, but we'd like to see more of you. And again, you could reference last week's call for details on this, but it helps us to know what's going on your end, what you're doing. And so by providing us those metrics, it gives us the ability to better help you and assist you. As far as topic for today, the main topic that I wanted to make a discussion for today is with regards to making offers on multifamily properties or income property. So I wanted to kind of give you guys some guidelines to work from, the guidelines that I'm going to kind of give you are a means to help you make offers on properties quickly, help you determine, you know, what a property is worth without doing too much work at the front end. And you can always dig in deeper as far as, you know, getting into more details, et cetera. So there's two types of deals you're going to come across, right? So they are the what I call ROI deals or rental deals, and then there's the fix and flip. So the fix and flip, generally, you're talking about properties in a higher price point. So, you know, where the end value, and again, this depends on your market, but say, I'm going to use our example here in South Florida, you know, whenever you start getting into properties where the end value is $100,000, $130,000, $140,000, $150,000, you know, that typically is a property that where you're going to have in that neighborhood buyers that are buying to live inside the property, right? So, in that scenario, if you're making an offer on the property like that, typically the rents are not gonna, they're not gonna have tremendous ROI. And so you're really looking to make an offer where you're coming in low enough so that, you could wholesale it, somebody could buy it from you, and then be able to put in the necessary amount of repairs, fix it up, and then resell it, right? So that's what I consider to be a fix and flip. And typically when you're looking at the comp report, if you're looking at the comp report, like I showed you guys in the video that I did for you guys a couple weeks back on RealQuest and how to set up RealQuest properly with the reporting, you'll see that at the top of a comp report, most of the properties are owner-occupied, where the person that bought the property is also living inside. And then toward the bottom of the comp report, you're going to see more investor properties where you'll see a difference in between the mailing address and the property address, which is an indication that it's a absentee owner, investor, and so those are typically the prices that investors are buying these properties at and where you'd want to buy yours. So an ROI deal, however, typically is a property that somebody's going to buy as a rental property. They're looking at how much they're going to be able to make rental income, return on investment on the property. Typically, most of those properties are going to be in the lower price points, and again, this depends on your market. Could be anywhere between $15,000 to $20,000 to, you know, upwards of $80,000 to $90,000, and again, I'm excluding from that example places like California where the property prices are substantially higher. But typically, with an ROI type of property, when you look at the comp report, you'll look and see that most of the properties that are being purchased are purchased by investors. It's really not an owner-occupied somebody buying in that price point to move into. And the reason for that is most of the time, if somebody has enough credit and income to qualify for a mortgage, they're going to buy in a nicer neighborhood. I mean, that's just the reality of it, and not going to buy in that price point, in that 50, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, $80,000 price point. What I wanted to kind of explain to you guys is that when we're looking at those type of properties, whenever we get a call and the guy says, person says, you know, I'm renting this property for $800 a month and I want, you know, $40,000 for this deal. Many times we don't try and evaluate that property using the comps. We'll make an evaluation and we'll make an offer based on an ROI and how much money is going to be available to say if somebody bought that property, paid cash for it, and then they got a cash flow on that on a per month basis. What would that cash flow look like? And we would make that offer based on that cash flow, right? So let's say that we do have somebody that calls in and says, using an example of somebody says that they have a property that's getting $800 a month in rent, and they leave a message and they say they want $50,000 for that property, right? So how do you evaluate that property when, if you look at the total comp report, you'll notice that the comps in that area go anywhere between, say, $95,000 all the way down to, let's say, $35,000, and all of them seem to be investor-type properties. So how do we evaluate that property? How do we make the offer? So the first thing is whenever we are evaluating a property based on ROI, of course, we need to know the rent amount. Sometimes the owner will leave the rent amount on the message. Sometimes they will not, so you'll have to call and ask the owner, what are you getting for rent on the property? When you ask the owner what they're getting for rent, they could tell you one of three things. They could tell you the rent amount, which is easy, right? Number two, they could tell you it's none of your business. Or number three, they could say it's vacant right now. So let's say that a seller says to you that it's none of your business. I don't want to tell you what it's rented for. The answer to that is just simply, you know, Mr. Seller, I appreciate the fact that you want to keep that information private, and I can certainly understand you wanting to keep it private because, again, we're just talking for the first time ever. You don't know me. I don't know you. However, in order for us to consider buying your property, you know, we need to know the rent amount because we're buying it for the purposes of us buying it and creating a cash flow from it because of the rent. And so we don't know what the rent amount is or what you're getting in rent for the property, then we're not able to make an analysis to determine what we could pay and if, in fact, you know, we're interested. And anybody else, for that matter, that's interested in your property would have to know that information. So, Mr. Seller, I really need to know that. And again, whatever information you tell me stays with me. It doesn't go anywhere else. I'm only using it for the purposes of you and I having a conversation to see if the property fits what I'm looking for, and that's it and nothing else. And most of the time, 90%, 95% of the time, they will give you that information if they didn't want to give it to you initially. If they still don't want to give you the information, there's really not a whole lot you can do. Most of the time, I just say, you know what, then there's no way I can make you an offer. There's no way I can consider the property. And at this point, you know, really there's not much that I can do with you here on the phone unless I know that information. Now, sometimes they might tell you that the property is vacant. Now, if they say the property is vacant, the next question would be is, well, how long has it been vacant? And they might say, well, it's been vacant for a couple months. At that point, then you might say to them, well, you know, what did you have it rented for before? So what was the previous rent amount? Another question you can ask them is, well, if you were to take and put it on the market right now to rent it, how much do you think you can get for the rent amount right now in today's market? Now, if you ask them what the rent amount is currently let's say that either they had it rented 2 months ago and now it's vacant, or let's say that they do tell you it's $800 a month right now, one of the questions that I always like to ask is, how long has that tenant been in there? So if they say, well, that tenant was in there about a year ago, we just put them in, then you can assume that that rent is pretty much a market rent, right? Because it's a new tenant. However, if they tell you this tenant has been in the property for 7 years, and so then that could mean that that rent amount there is not it's not an accurate market rent. It could be that maybe they got them in at $700 a month and they raised it $100 over the period of the last 6 or 7 years, but not much else because they don't want to have the tenant move out. But in actuality, that rent really right now in today's market is really $1,000 a month. Now, so really we use this information. We're still going to make an offer based on the current rent amount, but knowing that it's below market allows us to pitch it a little bit better to the buyers, and we could say, you know, right now it's only $800 a month, but if you got this tenant out, you did some paint carpet, you could probably get a couple extra $100 a month, so you'll make more money on the deal. However, though, again, we only make the offer based on the $800 per month, the current rent. Now, as far as calculating the ROI, you could do this a couple different ways. Some people will go ahead and will do a whole spreadsheet calculation, which is they'll take and they'll want to calculate, okay, what's the gross rent? What's that amount to on a yearly basis? What is the approximate cost for insurance, for property taxes, for repairs and all that other stuff, and then just come up with a really, really accurate number. And for me, I don't do that anymore just because it's too much work and it's really unnecessary. So typically the way I work is off a gross ROI number, right? And the gross number that I typically work is anywhere between 20 to 25% gross ROI. Right, so I'll share with you how to calculate that really quickly in case you don't really know. But now the reason I do 20 to 25% is because typically if I can pick up a property where the cash on cash rate of return is somewhere between 20 to 25% in a reasonable area, and I'll discuss what I mean by a reasonable area in a second, then that means that I have a pretty good chance of selling that property. Because if it's 20 to 25%, by the time you take away all the other expenses and you calculate all the different miscellaneous calculations, you know, you're going to end up somewhere in the high teens as far as an ROI number, right? And now that number, though, when I said reasonable, it means also depending on the area, right? So I've done properties in areas where it's really, really a very, very bad area. Very difficult to move properties, and so anybody that buys deals there is going to want 30% rate of return gross, or maybe 35% because of the fact that it's a really bad area, the tenants make a lot of damages, they'll damage most of the time, they'll move out quickly, so there's a lot of turnover, and so the only way for an investor to really protect themselves, protect their cash flow, that 30-35%, has to be there because by the time they consider vacancies and repairs and everything else, that number gets brought down to maybe a 20% or maybe an 18%, et cetera, right? So so again, and then on the other side, you know, if you got a really nice area, nice neighborhood where it's, you know, just a really one of the nicer areas of town, then you might be able to fudge a little bit and be able to have, you know, be able to make the offer below the 20% margin. Maybe you might make an offer an 18% rate of return because of the fact that it's a nice area and, you know, investors are really going to want that area, et cetera. But generally, I'm looking at anywhere between 20 to 25%. So the average of that is, say, 23% about there. The way I calculate the ROI is just you simply take the 800 that the guy is telling you that he's getting per month. So it's 800 times 12, so that's very bad. I can't do any calculations without a calculator. 8 times 12 is $9,600, right? Now, in this case here, I'm gonna calculate this in two ways. So I'm going to calculate this based on my example that I gave you. The owner gave us a price of $50,000. So then what we're going to do take 9,600 divided by 50,000 is 0.192%, right? So that's 19.2%. So an example that I gave you, the seller is asking for $50,000 for the property, and at that rate, then it's a 20% rate of return, right? So in this scenario, right, so in this example, the way I approach this is now I'm looking at what's the spread that I can create. Now, the spread is a little different in that I look at it in terms of what's the spread that I can create on the percentages, not necessarily the purchase price, right? So, for example, in this particular property, you know, I could say, well, let's figure out what 25% is, right? So he's asking 20% cap rate. So how do we calculate to get the 25% of what price that would be? So I take the $800 per month, multiply that by 12, and I'm going to divide that by 0.25%. That gives me $38,400, right? So if I could get the property for $38,400, that means that I can buy it at 25% ROI. And let's say that if I were to sell it or I were to ask $48,000 for that same property, then that means that I got $9,600 divided by $48,000. So that's 20%. So if we follow along this example, the guy's asking $50,000 on an $800 per month cash flow. So that means that he's asking a 20% gross ROI. Then if I calculate a 25% gross ROI, I get $38,400, right? And say, hold on a second. That was the 25%. I lost my numbers here. Give me a second. 9,600 divided by 0.25. Yeah, 38,400. So let's say that I was going to offer, I thought, you know, if I could pick this property up for $38,400 and maybe I'll offer it to my investor buyers for $48,000, then that means $9,600 divided by $48,000, that means I'd be offering that property at about 20% cap rate, right? Because it's very similar to the 50. So what I'm looking at is I'm picking it up at 20%. He's offering at 20%. How much deeper of a discount can I get so that way I could still offer it to my investors at a pretty good rate on return? And so in this scenario, I might make an offer of $38,000. I might say, you know what, I'm going to offer these people enough so that I'm getting a 30% rate of return. So $9,600 divided by, let's say, 28%. 28% is $34,000. So if I got them to accept $34,000, that means that I'm buying it at a 28% cap, which means that I could then offer it to my investor buyers at $48,000 and offer them a 20% gross cap. I can offer it to them at $45,000 and it'll be an even better rate of return on investment. So that's generally how I'd make offers on cash flow property. So let's say you had a duplex. If you had a duplex or a triplex, what you're simply doing is taking all those units, putting them together, combining the cash flow on those units, getting what the total rent amount is going to be for the month, multiplying that for the year, and then calculating what's that rate of return. Because when you have a duplex or triplex or quad, it's very difficult to find comps because, you know, it's like, you know, many times you're not able to find comparables for that. So you really could only use an income type of analysis, and really that's what a buyer is going to do anyway. They're going to look at, hey, what's the rate of return that I have the opportunity to get on this property. And again, that also depends on the condition of the property, right? So if the property is in really poor shape, or the owner tells me, hey, they got moved out a couple months ago and somebody broke in, they stole all the plumbing, they stole all the copper pipes, so it needs a lot of work. So of course, I'm going to have to adjust my number further down because somebody's going to have to spend money in order to get it up to the right amount to get the rate of return. So let's say in this example that I was going to buy the property for $34,000, and let's say that I wanted to sell it for $48,000 in order to offer somebody a 20% cap. But let's say that it needed $15,000 in repairs. So, you know, that means that, or let's say $10,000 in repairs, that means that maybe I'd have to maybe offer to somebody a $38,000. So they'll put 10 in, and that means they're in at 48. So that means that gives them their 20%. which means that then I'd have to offer less to the owner in order to be able to at least, you know, make some decent money. So the only other factor that I look at when making an offer based on ROI is I look at the assessed value to try to find a way to validate that offer to the seller. And by that, I mean, in using this example, let's say that at this example that the owner called in and wanted 50, and I do my calculation, and it says that I should make an offer of $38,000 or about there. I look at the assessed value of the property, and let's say the assessed value of the property is $32,000, right? So by default, I will always move my offer down to the assessed value because it's easy for me to tell the owner, hey, let me ask you a question. Would you sell it for what it's assessed for in the county records? And you kind of play dumb. Like, you know, typically most of the properties we buy are assessed value. So that's what it's assessed for. That's what I'm offering you. You know, don't make me out to be the bad guy. It just happens to be that the county assessed your property much lower than you think it's worth, but that's what we buy them for. So typically I'll use the assessed value as a way to justify a lower price point. In this example, for example, let's say that I was thinking about offering $38,000, and let's say the assessed value was $25,000. And I thought, gee, that's a really low offer to make for $25,000. You know, I could still use the assessed value as a way to justify goodwill on my end. So I could tell the owner, you know what, typically on these type of properties, we're typically paying assessed value. Now, I notice here your property is assessed at $25,000. However, based on what you're telling me, based on the fact that you're getting $800 per month, and it sounds to me like, you know, the property's in pretty good shape, I could actually pay a little bit more. And so I could probably do $28,000 for the property, or maybe $32,000, whatever you decide, you know, would that number work for you? So again, I'm always using assessed value as either a way to bring the offer down use that as an excuse to bring the offer down, or I might use that to show goodwill to the owner by saying, hey, you know, I could offer you that much because that's what we're paying, but, you know, I'm a good guy and you got a good property, so here's what I'm willing to do. Now, what if the assessed value in that case was higher? What if the assessed value was $50,000 for that property, what he's asking? In that case, I really can't do anything with assessed value. I'm going to offer what I'm going to offer. So I'm not just because the property is assessed for $50,000 and it's assessed for more than what I thought I was going to offer, I'm not going to typically raise my offer. Now, let's say that my bottom line number that I was going to be really aggressive and offer $32,000 for that property, and let's say the assessed value was $33,000, you know, $1,000 here or there, I might say, you know what, I might offer the assessed value, but typically I'm not going to bid up the price substantially in order to show at least that I'm making an offer at the assessed value. Now, as far as the CAFs, just to go back, so the percentages, the ROIs, how do you figure out, you know, what are the ROIs for your markets or your areas? The easy way to do that is really to you know, this is what I've done when I go into a market and I really don't know much, is I just go on Craigslist. I look for your typical keywords that you would look for, handyman, investor special, hard money, cash, or whatever. And then I'd also look for ROI. And I'm looking for listings, and I'm looking for properties that are listed on Craigslist for sale, and I want to know what those ROI numbers are. And if, in fact, if they're being calculated on a gross basis or a net basis, most of the time people will throw out the gross ROI number because it's a better number, you know, 20% return on investment, buy this deal, et cetera. And then they'll, you know, and whoever's buying it, excuse me, typically will work out the numbers themselves. But I go through Craigslist and I figure out, like, hey, it looks like in this market, you know, investors are being offered deals at, you know, in the high teens as far as ROI, 16, 17, 18%, depending on how the property looks, depending on how the area looks, et cetera. And so that's kind of how I gauge, you know, that number. For us, you know, the 20, 25, and maybe sometimes even pushing 30% works as far as making the offers. And in the end, you really don't know what the end price is going to command in the market once you take the property and you put it out there to your buyer's list or get other wholesalers to look at it for you. But doing the ROI at that number at least you know you're getting it at a pretty good price. It's a pretty good rate of return for somebody, and you have a chance at making some money on that deal. But let me see what other notes I had there. I think that's so I wanted to just kind of give you, because we got some questions in with regards to, hey, you know, putting costs on duplexes and triplexes and multifamilies, and it's very difficult to do that. So either with single-family houses in rental areas or in the multifamily, this I found is the easiest way, the best way to try to calculate what we think we can offer and what we think we can put it out there and make some money on a deal if it's a rental type property.
Chris, can I add something to that?
Yeah.
Before we get to any questions, well, all I was going to add is it's important to verify. You know, the expression trust but verify, and it's especially true with Section 8 properties, because we actually had a case on the duplex deal, Chris, we're working on right now, where the seller told us a certain rent amount he was getting, but he actually wasn't getting that much. He told us he was getting $1,900, but he was actually getting $1,700 from Section 8 and the rest from the tenants, right? So especially with Section 8 tenants, you definitely want to verify the rent amount. And then also, as soon as you can, just try to get a copy of the lease or some kind of verification of the income, because it's one thing to just take the seller off, you know, on their word, but it's another to get it in writing. Don't you think, Chris?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that so a couple things about that. It's definitely whatever they tell you, take it with a grain of salt. You do the best you can to get whatever information you can, and then, you know, sometimes to the verification depends on the buyer, because we've had the experience, Calvin, with some buyers will want an estoppel letter, they'll want all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, and some of them they don't really care too much. So it just depends on the buyer. One thing that we have found is that when you're dealing with Section 8 and somebody says it's rented for $1,500 a month, Section 8, it's always good to verify what the payment structure is. So typically with Section 8, Section 8 will pay a certain amount, and then the tenant has to pay another amount. So let's say if it's $1,500 a month, it may be that Section 8 pays $1,350, and then the tenant pays $150. However, what I found is that sometimes the owners are not too strict on collecting the tenant's portion of the rent amount. And so they might say $1,500 a month, Section 8, but they might only collect the $150 every couple months from the tenant because they don't have the money, but they don't want to mess around with it because they're getting their check from Section 8 enough to cover and give them a good profit, so they're not going to make a stink about it. But it's good to know that, because if you have an experienced buyer, they'll know that, hey, I know it's guaranteed the $1,350, but the $150, maybe I might get it, maybe I won't. And so they'll make the right calculations on that. And so you want to put as much of that information out there in the beginning, because the last thing you want is for the buyer to come in at the end of the deal and say, well, a day before closing, a couple of days before closing, say, I didn't realize this was a rent amount and that's not going to fly with me, and now we got a problem because we need a price reduction, et cetera, which I think we've had
that's what happened with the duplex. It's the most important, because if anything, they're going to be getting less rent than what they tell us. And so it's important to verify, because if they're getting less rent, then all those numbers that we just went over don't apply, because the gross annual rent is less. If the monthly is less, then the gross is less, so the return is less, right? So it's important to find out the information, but it was definitely a lesson for me, and I hope for everyone can learn from this on the duplex deal, that it's so important to verify it as soon as possible. You need to say, oh, you know, next time we meet down at the property, could you just bring a copy of the lease, or do you mind sending me an email with the Section 8 agreement? And I think most of the time the sellers will agree to that.
Yeah. And then the other thing, just a quick question about the rent, since we're talking about that. You and I have had this discussion quite a bit of times about estoppel letters. So an estoppel letter is basically, it's a document It's just a simple document that verifies the rent that's being received on the property, right? And so it depends if a buyer is smart enough. I'm going to tell you what's the easiest estoppel letter to get and what's the most difficult estoppel letter to get. And one, and they're both dependent really on the buyer. It's really what the buyer wants. And the more, if you have a buyer that knows what he's doing, he's going to ask for the most difficult one. So the easiest estoppel letter to get is a document that's really filled out by the owner. And he says, I'm getting this amount in rent, and I have this amount in deposit. And he might say, I'm getting $1,000 a month in rent, and I don't have a deposit on the transaction at all. And some buyers may be okay with that. However, the challenge with this type of estoppel letter is that the owner might be lying. The owner might say, oh, the tenant is current. He's paying me $1,000 a month, and I have zero deposit. When in actuality, the tenant could be a month and a half behind in rent. He could have a $1,500 deposit last month's rent from the tenant, and then, he's not really getting that rent that he says he's getting. And so, however, though, so the next best estoppel letter, the best estoppel letter is really one that's signed by both the buyer, by both the seller and the tenant. So that there's a document in writing that says, hey, what's the rent amount? Are there any past due amounts? And is there a security deposit or last month's rent or whatever? And both the seller and both the buyer have to sign that, which means that now everybody's on the same page. This more difficult one, we try to avoid it. Not that we don't discourage it, but we give the buyer the option. If the buyer says we want an estoppel letter, we'll tell the buyer, okay, well, here's the document that I have. I'm going to take this document, and I'm going to have the seller fill it out for me. Now, I just want to make sure that this is what you want. And then we have them tell us. They might say, yeah, that's fine. That's good enough for me. And the story, we get it from the owner. Or they might come back and say, oh, no, we want the tenant to fill that out. We want the tenant and the owner to both fill that out. And so, we'll do it because we want to make the deal. More work on our end because now, we got to go to the property and we got to meet with the tenant. And the tenants usually are not the most friendliest people because they don't see you as a good guy in the whole transaction because they're thinking they're going to be thrown out once the property closes. And so, but it just depends. It depends on what information the buyer wants. In the past, who is it, I'm drawing a blank here, Calvin, who is it that's been asking for the estoppel letters? Is it the buyers or is it the title company? Who's typically the one that's asking for it?
Well, it's the buyers, because the buyer is the one that's going to get the credit at the closing for the prorated rent amount and the security deposit.
Right, so they're the ones. Now, just from your recollection, if you look at the easy one and then the hard one where we have to get the tenant to sign and everything else, most of them are okay with the easy one, right?
They're okay with the easy one. And another thing that I'm not sure you mentioned this, but if there's a lease, if they have a lease, then we don't really need the estoppel letter because the lease explains it. If it's a lease that is current and we're selling the property and the lease is valid through, a date past the closing date, then you don't really need the estoppel letter because the lease explains everything. But if the lease has expired before the closing date and they're on a month-to-month lease or they're just there on a month-to-month agreement, then you need the estoppel letter because that's going to tell the buyer how much of the security deposit they're going to get and how much the prorated rent for the current month.
Right.
So it's better to get, I think it's better to get the lease. If there's a lease, that's what you want to get. If there's no lease or the lease expired, you can still get a copy of the expired lease, but then you want to get the estoppel letter. Also.
Right. The other thing to think about is the fact that when all is said and done, okay, always err on the side of more information than less, right? Because if you really think about it, our client is not the seller, right? The sellers come and go. We get, most of the time we're dealing with a seller that has one property. They buy it. We're not dealing with agents, right? So we're dealing with a one-off sale. That's it. They're done. So our clients and our people that we do business with are really our customers, are our buyers. So whether that be the investor buyer directly, it could be another wholesaler. And so we want to make sure that they're okay, because the last thing you want is then a buyer coming back to you and saying, hey, the title company never collected the security deposit, but the tenant now saying that there's a security deposit, and now I'm short $1,000. And guess what? If you made, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 on a deal, if you want to keep that, you know, you could tell the buyer, hey, tough luck. I mean, that's how the way the cookie crumbles, and that's life in the fast lane in the big city, but he's not going to like that too much, and so you're probably going to have to compensate him for that, because he's your buyer and you want him to continue buying from you. So, you know, the other, I guess, the last comment on that would be that, if anything, always err on the side of, you know, it's a combination of you don't want to go out and do too much work, but you want to trust and verify things so that in the end, people are not going to come back to you after the closing and say, hey, this is not what I was told and we got a problem here. So if anybody has any questions on this specifically, or actually anything else for that matter, you can hit star 5, and star 5 will open up the line, will raise your hand, star 5 to raise your hand. I don't know if Gary's still here, but I'm not sure if you are here, Gary, if you wanted to make a comment or two about what I just talked about.
No, I think you covered covered really good, unless there's specific questions. Looks like, is that Freddie?
Yes, hold on. Freddie.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm good. How about you, buddy?
Good, thanks. Hey, I don't know if I missed it, but when you were talking about coming up with the offer, I understand the annual rent divided by either 0.20 or 0.25. Now, what do we do to resell it? What do we use for a resale standpoint?
Well, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make as much money as I can, but also offer as good of a deal as possible. So let's say, in a perfect world, we would make an offer at 30% ROI, and then we'd be able to take the property and put it out there at 20% ROI, gross ROI, and so, you know, the deal will go quickly. People, you know, buyers will get a great deal. But that may not always be the case. It might be a deal where we pick up at 22% or 20% ROI, and then, you know, we might say in order for us to make 10K on the deal, we have to offer it at, say, 17% ROI. And it might be a little bit, you know, tight, but we might take a chance on it. So as far as the offer and what you're going to offer the buyers, it's a combination of looking at, you know, how much you're looking to make on the deal and how much that money that you want to make is going to impact. Because let's say if you picked up a deal 20% ROI and you want to make 10K, but if you took the 10K into the picture, all of a sudden now the ROI was only 13%, because, you know, it was a very low price deal. Then, you know, trying to make 10K off of that deal is probably going to be too much, you know, because it's going to make the deal too skinny for somebody, and you're not going to be able to sell it. Does that make sense?
Okay, so, so basically rule of thumb is try to get it between 25 and 30 and try to move it at 20% or 18%.
Rule of thumb is hard to try and see if you could, and correct me if this is incorrect, Calvin, but I think, if we could offer a deal in the high teens, if we could offer it to our buyers in the high teens, then many times it gives us a good chance of getting it sold. Would you agree with that, Calvin, or is that number not right?
The high teens as far as what exactly?
The ROI. Like if we can offer somebody a duplex and it's an 18% gross ROI, somewhere around there,
typically we should be able to move that, yeah.
Right. So the target for us is in the high teens. As far as what we might have out to, that means that then we'll have to pick it up, you know, in the 20s or you know, higher in order to put in our spread and then be able to sell it. But for that lesser amount, but still within the a good ROI number.
Gotcha. Okay.
Is that because I know that you were the reason why I made the call on this topic, Freddie. So does the call help as far as clearing that up?
Yes.
For the process for that?
Yeah, because I came across two or three multifamily on the last mailing. I just want to make sure that, you know, I'm offering it in the right time, at the right price.
Right. And also, just to clarify, I mean, I make the offers like this on even, you know, single family. So if you have a single family you come across that, you know, in that lower price point, and it's going to be a rental property, then you would use the same, you would use the same approach.
Gotcha.
Is there anything else that you wanted to ask while we're on the line, Freddie?
No, I'm good. You answered my question.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Thanks, buddy. Thanks for asking.
Not a problem.
All right. So again, if you have a question about this topic or perhaps any other topic, just go ahead and raise your hand. Let me see who this is. I have Spring, Texas on the line.
Hey, guys, this is Danny in Spring. How are you?
Hey, Danny. How are you?
Hanging in there. You know, this call comes at a pretty good time. I've been trying to sell a little multifamily property. The poor guy, he's out of state, and he's just had a heck of a time trying to, you know, keep the thing managed and whatnot. I mean, I've got it under contract, and of course, we're having to renegotiate because the buyers that I have look at it, you know, they agree it's in decent shape. But when they ask me for the normal information, I tell them, man, my owner has been terrible at keeping records, and his manager has been terrible at collecting rents and all that. And so I feel foolish talking to these people. I give them everything that I've got, but for some reason, I'm even having a challenge. I've gotten a couple of offers that came in, but, you know, not being a veteran wholesaling, you know, small multifams. Again, this is a 21-unit single-story apartment complex here in town. And, you know, it's a challenge, you know. So, I probably won't have done it just because, you know, they think just because it's under rented and could use a little rehab or whatever, it seems like they're scared to make an offer or something. And most of them, they want to get into something that's completely out of the rent. And it's like, how do you expect them to get a great discount on something unless you get in with a little challenges? You know, that's my mentality.
Hey,
anyway.
Can I add a couple of things? It's a 21 unit.
Yeah.
And how many one bedrooms, how many two bedrooms?
17 and 4. 17, 1,
17
one,
and 4. What I would do, have you built a Performa? So I've got the same thing. I've been buying multifamily. I picked up a 16 unit last year in California. I'm actually selling it right now. So what I would do is I would actually, and Chris, you may have some thoughts on this as well, but I'd be putting together your Performa and looking at what the cap rates are selling for other like-kind properties and what also they're selling per door. You probably have done that. But if you don't have real good numbers and you've at least got a Performa, I don't know if it's been recently reconditioned or any tenant turnover, but if you can, let's say, like, I picked up a property. It was a disaster. I mean, it was done by a contractor, and they did a good job on the rehab, but terrible, terrible property management. So the average price per door, LoopNet and CoStar are usually pretty good. If you got a reasonable realtor that'll flip properties and do deals with you, that's another way to go. But the average price per door within, you know, 16, so you're 21 units, so price per door between 16 units and probably 28 units will probably be pretty easy to figure out. So I was in Sacramento. The average price per door on like-kind property was about $54,000 a unit. And so I was able to pick that up for probably $15,000 below that per door. And I just ended up getting it renovated, and I'm going to turn it for market. So I don't know if that really helps, but that's one of the reasons why you end up getting smoking deals. And a lot of apartments, especially right now in apartments, there's a lot of money going into apartments, and so they'll be looking for performa anyway. And if you don't have really good record keeping, as long as you got a good performa and you got a good average vacancy rate. I don't know what the average vacancy rate is in your area, you know, and usually 38% is a good on a 21 unit, 38% expense ratio. So if you need some help, Danny, I've got some tools for helping you calculate that.
Good, thank
you. So I got all kinds of like extra stuff. If you want to text me, I'll ask you a handful of questions and give you. I got some tools that can crank out, if you don't already have them, cranked out performa and what the operating ratios and cap rates, and you can actually give it to your buyer so they can do their own numbers. The cap rate on your property in that area is probably what? If performa, I would imagine they're selling in probably a 10%, the 10 cap maybe, 10 to 13 cap.
Well, the software I was using figured it a little higher than that, but I think there was a flaw in the formula, and so I need to attack it with a different piece of software, and that really set me behind. But,
yeah. If you want, and Chris, you can add. This might actually be worthwhile, at least on the apartment side. But maybe, Danny, if we work on this together, and then together we can record a video, kind of follow this along and then put it out there, because I think there's a lot of money to be made down the road on doing sort of the larger apartment flips as down the road for people that actually want to also do that. Definitely not ideal, strategy that's sort of what we're all focused on, but it would probably be good to have something recorded and some tools that we could give to people on how to calculate it, because it is definitely a little different than doing like a 1-4 unit calculation.
Yes, sir.
So if you want, text me. We'll get on the phone, kind of see if we can calculate it together. I just went through this whole exercise, and we've been buying apartments, and I picked up this 16 unit, and I'm actually in the process of unloading it right now. I hate small apartments. I had to turn the whole darn thing over. I ended up having drug addicts and a drug dealer in the apartment, and I literally turned the whole darn thing over. I evicted everybody and cleaned it up, and I'm selling it full price retail. I just literally listed it a couple of days ago for a little under $1 million.
Nice.
So we could do that and then record a little video. Chris, are you good with that?
Yeah, I don't have an issue with that. My only comment I was going to make is I agree with you with the pro forma of a unit that size, even if they're not collecting all the rent, that you need to have at least something formalized that gives somebody a picture of what things could be. And then the other part of it is once you have that in place, it comes down to the combination of price and distribution. And by distribution, I mean that you can have a property at a great price, but if you don't have the right distribution, if you're not putting it in the hands of the right buyers or the other wholesalers who have buyers, and you're not doing the things necessary to get it out, it could be a great property, but nobody knows about it, it's not going to sell. And on the flip side, you can have tremendous distribution. And if you do have that, and if you have the ability to talk to buyers that are legitimate buyers that know what they're doing, then the other part of it is input. If you start getting offers, and all the offers tend to be about the same price point and the same price range, then that tells you, because the property is really only worth what a willing and able buyer is willing to pony up and pay for it. And so in the end, what your objective is, you want to get to that point where either you have sold it or you have enough evidence to tell you, here's what, what it's worth, because I got 4 or 5 legitimate buyers that are ready to take their checkbook out, but they're all within this price point, which means that that's maybe the market value of the deal.
Mm-hmm. You're wholesaling this one, Danny?
What's that?
Are you wholesaling this?
Yes.
And do you know what the average price per door is in the area?
it's a tough one because it's an older area and there's no I know we looked up the rents. We know it's grossly under rented as well per door.
Yeah.
Not sure right now at the price point. We're at about 27 a door.
Okay.
So I would have to see based on the difference in rents. It would I'm thinking the average in the area is probably 5, you know, something like that maybe.
So you're picking up for 27 and you think the market rate is performing, is it 45 a door?
Give or take, yes.
I think you're going to make some money on that, brother.
Well, we're trying, but I think what Chris just said kind of hits it on the head. I mean, I've gotten
yeah.
a lot of response.
Yeah.
But, you know the quality of these guys, I need to follow up with them all, let them know that we're trying to renegotiate because it's a sub-2 deal, actually. You know, we can take over
yeah.
the payments.
Yeah.
You know, the guy's only trying to get as much equity as he can out of the deal. You know, he's tired of coming out of pocket every month. You know, he lives out there in California, and there's, you know, so it's got the ingredients of a great deal. It's just, you know, if this thing tanks, it'll probably be because of me, not because of the deal, you know. So, you know, but we're still pushing it, you know.
Yeah. Well, keep it posted. Any help we can give you, you know, let us know. And, you know, I'd love to be able to help you, you know, put that together. But just hopefully,
yeah.
you know, with Gary and also some of the stuff I've mentioned, perhaps you might give you a few more avenues to try to a direction in order to get this thing moved.
Perfect.
Yeah. Two last things, Danny, and just text me. I'd be more than happy to. We'll definitely jump on this with you if you'd like.
Good.
Have you clouded title at all? Do you have any memorandum or option agreement that's tying up the property so somebody's not going to go directly to the seller, or do you have a really good? Okay. But nothing on title. You haven't recorded anything.
No. Like an affidavit or anything. No.
Yeah.
I should have.
Well, call. And you got a good relationship with the seller?
Yeah, we've got a great trust factor. It gives me everything I need, and we've got great rapport. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I'll be more than happy to work with you on that. I would be a little bit worried if somebody, as soon as you kind of start marketing, of somebody going out from under and trying to connect directly with the seller on this one, because you could have a six-figure, well into the six-figure profit margin. I would imagine, I don't know what you're looking at, but let's stay on a call and knock through it, and I'd love to record it and provide it to the rest of the group once we get further and you get this thing close to selling.
Sure thing.
If you want the
absolutely,
help.
Absolutely, no, thank you.
Sounding board, so cool.
All right. Gary, I think you got to jump off, right? You got
yeah.
a call scheduled right after this?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
All right. I don't have any other questions, so, again, guys, this call will be available in the members area within very quickly by tomorrow. So if you have any questions about this, let us know. And again, I appreciate everybody being on the call. I hope you find the call information here helpful and insightful, and look forward to our future call next week. Thanks again, everybody. Have a good day.